Greetings. Welcome to Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney, coming to you today, December 17th, 2006, from Campbell Hall on the campus of the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign. We've got a live show for you today. Today, we have a special guest, as usual. In the 4.5 years we've done Media Matters, we've had approximately 230, 240 shows that we've put together. Only two guests are identified in our program without any identification but their name. They're that well known. One, Noam Chomsky, was on the air a couple weeks ago with us. The other will be our guest today, Howard Zinn, joining us today live on Media Matters. But first, let's go to Media Minutes.
Welcome to Media Minutes, a weekly review of news relating to the intersection of media and democracy. I'm John Anderson.
And I'm Kimberly Cronick.
More than 500 people converged on Belmont University in Nashville, Tennessee, December 11th for the Federal Communications Commission's second official public hearing on its potential plans to allow for more media consolidation. Nashville being the de facto country music capital of the world, the audience was filled with country music stars young and old who all hammered home the point that big media should most definitely not be allowed to get even bigger. The hearing itself took more than 9 hours to complete. Singer-songwriter John Rich said consolidation in radio has directly affected an artist's ability to build an audience and sustain their craft. Not only that, he said there's outright blacklisting going on in the industry, obliquely referencing the saga of the Dixie Chicks and their virtual disappearance from the country radio dial after one of them made a disparaging remark about the president 3 years ago.
Let's say an artist puts out a song with a social comment or a political stance towards something, and Gentleman X here goes, you know what? I don't believe in that comment, so I'm going to instruct my radio stations to not add that song. One guy can affect what 30 million people get to hear. That's censorship.
And country music legend George Jones, who's won 2 Grammys and charted more songs than any other artist in popular music history, minced no words.
I hate to think that some of these radio station owners could own even more television stations and newspapers. You know, sugar is sweet, but too much can kill you.
Public testimony at the hearing covered a much broader range of issues involving media ownership and access to the airwaves. Mark McKinley, a resident of Louisville, Kentucky, the hearing drew attendees from at least 6 states, gave the FCC a direct example about how local newspapers and TV stations hardly even try to cover substantive stories that occur literally in their own backyards.
This past August, our grassroots Louisville media reform community hosted an event in an effort to raise awareness about the net neutrality issue. We were one block from the Courier-Journal, a Gannett chain. We were within 1 mile of 3 of the 4 major TV stations, and it was only the local independent weekly who showed up to cover the story. And that's the way it is a lot of times.
And Victoria Strange simply implored the commissioners to heed to common sense when they discussed changing the media ownership rules.
As I understand it, the FCC's own studies show that the effects of media consolidation have been harmful to the public interest. To me, it appears your decision on this issue should be a simple matter.
The first round of public testimony on the FCC's Media Ownership Rules Review closes on December 21st. Visit www.stopbigmedia.com for more on the Nashville action and how you can add your own voice to the FCC's deliberations. At least 4 more official FCC public hearings on the subject are expected to occur in the new year.
Interestingly enough, Robert McDowell was the only FCC commissioner to skip the hearing in Nashville. He sent a staffer in his place, saying he needs time to bone up on the FCC's pending vote to approve the merger of AT&T with Bell South. For the last several months, McDowell has recused himself from consideration of the merger because he previously lobbied the FCC on behalf of a trade association for independent phone companies. This has hung up deliberations on the merger's conditions, which split the FCC's vote to approve the deal between the 2 other Republican members and the 2 Democrat commissioners who refuse to approve any merger that does not contain provisions to protect against skyrocketing rates and preserve the principle of network neutrality. Because of this impasse, an FCC vote to approve the merger has already been delayed 3 times. But recently, FCC Chairman Kevin Martin convinced the agency's main lawyer to issue a memorandum clearing the way for McDowell to vote without technically violating federal ethics rules regarding conflict of interest. However, the memo itself says McDowell's participation could still raise troubling questions about the objectivity of his participation in any vote, questions only McDowell himself can really address and answer. Commissioner Robert McDowell does not have to vote on the merger if he does not feel comfortable doing so, though he is under significant political pressure to participate. Another FCC attempt to vote the merger through could happen by as early as January.
We're less than 1 month from the start of the National Conference for Media Reform to be held January 12th through the 14th in Memphis, Tennessee. Registration is still open. Visit www.freepress.net/conference to find out more. You've been listening to Media Minutes, a joint production of the Illinois Initiative for Media Policy Research at the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign and Free Press, a national nonpartisan organization dedicated to media democracy. For more information, visit our website at freepress.net.
Greetings. Welcome back to Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney, coming to you from WILL AM 580. In beautiful Urbana, Illinois, on a sultry December afternoon here. I'm coming to you from Campbell Hall on the campus of the University of Illinois. Today we have a live show, and our guest is someone who I said really needs no introduction, Howard Zinn, author of numerous books on American history and on politics, a playwright, and really a seminal figure for many Americans and many people around the world in understanding the political situation and the history of this country. It's a pleasure to welcome Howard Zinn to Media Matters today. Howard?
Oh, hello, Bob. Thank you for inviting me.
Well, that's...
I mean, what else would I do on a Sunday afternoon?
Watch the Patriots?
No, they're not worth watching this year.
Really? Okay. Well, you've got a brand new book out that I've been following closely called A Power Governments Cannot Suppress.
Mm.
What is the book about and why that title?
Oh, well, what is the book about? It's hard to say, actually. The book is a collection. I was prompted to do it by Greg Ruggiero and City Lights books, and I'm happy to be published. You know, City Lights is a very distinguished old publishing outfit, you know, Lawrence Ferlinghetti and Allen Ginsberg and all of those people. So the book itself is a collection of pieces I've written in the last few years, a lot of them for the Progressive magazine, but also for other publications. And, you know, a lot of it is on the war. A lot of it is on Iraq, although it goes back to Afghanistan, and have something on Hiroshima, and something even on that's how far back we go, to the Boston Massacre. And I have an essay on Henry David Thoreau, and I talk about nationalism and American exceptionalism and civil liberties and Philip Berrigan and Eugene Debs and Sacco and Vanzetti. You can see.
You're covering a lot of ground.
It covers a lot of ground.
Well, why the title, Howard Zinn?
Why the title? A Power Governments Cannot Suppress. That's what I asked the publisher. Why this title? Why a title with so many words? But I guess they're taking it from a theme of mine, which is that the power of elites, the power of authorities, the power of the state is actually more fragile than it looks. That is, these are the people on the top. They have control. They have the economy. They have the army. They have the media. And it very often looks as if they're all powerful. And my point is, no, they're not. And some history is necessary in order to understand that. That is, if you don't have any history, then you are sort of oppressed by the moment. And at the moment, at any given moment, you, the individual, look weak compared to the power of the authorities. But if you have some historical perspective, you look back and you see that governments that seemed to be in total control were not, that institutions which seemed to be dominant crumbled when people gathered and protested. Well, take a look at corporations. Take a look at the history of the labor movement. And look at all those very powerful corporations which seemed invulnerable to unionization. I'm thinking of the history of the 1930s, you know, when Ford Motor Company said, oh, no one is going to organize us, General Motors and U.S. Steel. Oh, no, we're never going to have a union here. Well, when the workers got together, when they organized, when they went on strike, the people in authority were helpless. And this actually is the sort of the principle that the people in power depend for their power on the subservience of others, of the citizenry, on obedience. When the citizenry stop obeying, the power of the elite crumbles. And we've seen this sort of again and again, not just in the labor movement. Well, we saw it ourselves in the movements of recent years. You know, the power of the white South in this country looked untouchable. I mean, I was living in the South, and they, you know, during the years of the beginning of the civil rights movement, and before you had the sit-ins and the freedom rides and the marches, and the South looked as if it were totally in the hands of the of white supremacy, and it didn't look. And furthermore, they were getting kind of quiet collaboration from the federal government, and so they looked invulnerable. But once black people marched out into the streets and began to commit civil disobedience and created an enormous turmoil in the country, well, the power of the white South suddenly crumbled and the segregation barriers went down. So, you know, we see this again and again. And these people at the top who say, I will never do this, I mean, guess who I'm thinking of?
Mm-hmm.
We will never, you know, cut and run, right? We will never surrender, etc. The people who say this are going to cut and run at some point. I mean, after all, Lyndon Johnson in the Vietnam War said, oh, no, we are not going to cut and run. We're not going to leave Vietnam. But we did. And the reason is that an enormous movement was created in this country. And when a movement of citizens is created and people begin to press against the power of the establishment and defy it, and when soldiers refuse to fight in the war anymore, well, they lose their power.
Our guest today, Howard Zinn. You're listening to Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney, coming to you on WILL AM 580. Howard Zinn is the author of numerous books over the years. The most recent book, A Power Governments Cannot Suppress, just released recently by City Lights Books. He's probably most famously known for his classic book, A People's History of the United States. If you'd like to call in with a question or comment for Howard Zinn, the phone number here at Media Matters is 333-9455, our toll-free number, 1-800-222-9455. There's so much I'd like to talk with you about today, Howard. I'd like to just go back in history, if we could, for one question that comes up with my students all the time, and I see sort of debated. What is your sense of the founding fathers? Their names are invoked invariably, positively usually, sometimes negatively.
Yeah, well, it's interesting because there's an enormous glorification of the founding fathers and idealization and sure, the founding fathers were very actually intelligent people, well-spoken. I compare them to our leaders of today, and just in terms of, you know, their literary ability, the fact that they read books and so on, they were impressive. And yes, they got together and they created the Constitution with which we are living today. So there's, you know, there's something to be said for them. On the other hand, it should be understood who they were. They were not the people of the United States. They did not represent the people of the United States. They did not represent a working people. They did not represent black people. I mean, 20% of the country were black slaves. They certainly did not represent Native Americans, whose land these white Europeans, including the founding fathers, were occupying. I mean, they got together, 55, basically rich white men got together in Philadelphia in 1787, and they drafted a document, the Constitution, you know, which is much praised and glorified and, you know, overpraised, I'm claiming. And they created a document that set up a strong central government. And very often this is looked upon. And I remember when I was going to school, they said, wow, you know, the country was really divided into these different states, and we needed a strong authority, and the founding fathers created a constitution and a strong national government. Well, there's truth to that. They did create a strong centralized government. But what was their motive, and what was the outcome of this strong central government? The motive was to have a government that would be able to control the rebellions that were taking place in various parts of the country. The year before the founding fathers got together in Philadelphia to draft the Constitution, that is, they got together in 1787, the year before, 1786, there was a rebellion of farmers in western Massachusetts. People very often learn about this in school, Shays' Rebellion. Usually they learn about it only as a sort of something on a multiple-choice test, but don't learn a lot about it. But Shays' Rebellion was a rebellion of farmers, many of them veterans of the Revolutionary War, who came out after the war, were given a little bit of land, and then were taxed so heavily by the wealthy people who controlled the legislature in Massachusetts that they could not pay the taxes, and their farms and livestock were being taken away from them. And so they rebelled, thousands and thousands of them. They surrounded the courthouses. They wouldn't allow the auctions to go on. Now, the reason I mention this in connection with the Founding Fathers and the Constitution is because the connection between Shays' Rebellion and the making of the Constitution is, so far as I know, never mentioned in college classrooms. Certainly wasn't in mine, right up through graduate school, not mentioned in textbooks. But the connection is that the Founding Fathers, when they got in Philadelphia in 1787, were very cognizant of the fact that rebellions of farmers were taking place, not just in western Massachusetts, but in other parts of the country, in other states. And they were worried about the fact that these people who were without wealth and who resented the wealthy might continue to rebel. So they wanted a strong central government that would protect them against such rebellion, protect slave owners against slave rebellion, protect settlers and expansionists against the Indians, whose land they were moving into, protect the bondholders who had bought up the bonds issued by the Revolutionary War government. In other words, they set up a government that would protect the interests of the rich. And in fact, they did a very good job of it, because that structure, that government that they set up in 1787, has persisted down to the present day, serving the same interests. You can find an unbroken line from the first measures passed by Congress, the Hamiltonian economic program, which benefited the banks and the bondholders, a direct line from that to the oil depletion allowances of today, to the corporate welfare, to the tax benefits given to the richest 1% of the country. So the founding fathers, yes, they're very competent and very thoughtful people, and some of the things they said then are worth repeating today, like Madison's concern that the president should not get the power to make war. And they did agree after some protest, they did agree to a Bill of Rights in the Constitution. But, you know, I think they should be seen realistically and not heroically. And I would like a lot more attention paid to the ordinary people of the revolutionary period, to those I mean, before, it should be understood, and I urge people to read the very interesting book by Ray Raphael, a California writer, wrote a book called The First American Revolution. Before even the shots were fired at Lexington and Concord in 1775, much of the English-controlled colonies were actually taken over by local people, grassroots democracy. Now, these people, these ordinary people, and the soldiers who fought in the Revolution, not Washington and not the generals, but the ordinary GIs who fought in the Revolution and were betrayed after the Revolution, I think these are the people we should pay more attention to instead of putting out book after book, volume after volume about Jefferson and Madison and Hamilton and so on.
Our guest today is Howard Zinn. You're listening to Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney. Howard Zinn is the author of the brand new book, A Power Governments Cannot Suppress, put out by City Lights Book, the author of countless other books. He has been active in American political life for, dare I say it,
Five or six hundred years.
Well, I wasn't going to say that. The number here, if you'd like to call in and speak with Howard Zinn, 333-9455, our toll-free number, 1-800-222-9455. We have a few callers who've been waiting patiently. Let's go to the phone lines now. Line 1, Lombard, Illinois, you're on the air with Howard Zinn.
Well, hi, good afternoon, and nice honor to speak with you, Professor Zinn.
Hi.
Listen, my question was this. What role do you perceive that the online progressive sort of net roots are having on the alternative party, the Republicans that we have, the Democratic Party? I'd just be curious to get your take on that to see if you think it's having a positive or negligible impact on things.
Now, what is having an impact?
The online activism, like I assume things like Move On or even further to the left of that, that try to use the internet as a way to organize people and galvanize progressive politics.
Right, yeah. Okay. I guess the reason I hesitate is because I came so late to online. You know, I'm still, you know, doing other things, but I do go online. Now, I think that and now I find, you know, I tune in on email and I go to links that are given to me. I have a whole new vocabulary and about links and websites and so on and so forth. And what I find is that I get a huge amount of information that I don't get in the mainstream press, that I certainly don't get on, you know, the main channels of television. So from my point of view, this online information, which is available, is extremely valuable as a counter to the control of the media. I mean, I'd be interested in Bob Chesney's view of this because he knows a lot more about the media and the control of the media and the counter media than I do. But my impression is that this is a very positive thing. I know this, that online I can have access to dispatches from European newspapers, from the Guardian of London, from newspapers in the Middle East, from newspapers all over the world. And, of course, if you read dispatches from Agence France-Presse and The Observer and so on, you get information that just doesn't appear in the American press.
Howard, let me follow up on that, though, with the second part, which I think the caller was really concerned with. The state of the Democratic Party is the official opposition to the Republicans, and whether this could be used as a way to sort of either get rid of the Democrats or make the Democrats more progressive or create an alternative. But in any case, I think the caller's concern is pushing the political boundaries to the left significantly.
Yeah. Well, since the Democratic Party is badly in need of a jab or seven jabs, Democratic Party, here it wins an election. It gets control of both houses of Congress, and then it kind of lays back. And instead of moving forward with that power and, let's say, moving to impeach the president and the vice president of the United States, it declares, no, impeachment is not on the table. And so we have a Democratic Party which badly needs a rank-and-file rebellion. And it would seem to me that the internet and an online organization is a very efficient way, very useful way to build up a grassroots opposition in a Democratic Party and pave the way, for instance, to support truly progressive candidates in the coming primaries, you know, for the presidential election, or coming caucuses in the presidential election. So yes, I see the internet as, I think, being an important weapon in, well, I suppose, in doing two things. And Bob suggested both of these. That is, one, to build a fire under the Democratic Party and put new and progressive and bold Democrats in leadership of the party. And second, to also create an alternative political movement outside of the Democratic Party, because there's probably nothing that would prod the Democratic Party into action more than fear that it is going to be pushed into the shadows by a third party that would excite and inspire people who in the past have voted Democrat.
Our guest, Howard Zinn. You're listening to Media Matters. We're coming to you live today in WILL AM 580 from beautiful Urbana, Illinois. 1 week from today, our guest will be another historian, Elizabeth Fones Wolfe, talking about her brand new book on labor radio in the 1940s, Waves of Opposition. So please join us then. If you'd like to call in with a question or comment for Howard Zinn, the number again, 333-9455. Toll free, 1-800-222-9455. Let's go back to the phone lines now. Portland, Maine, line 4. Welcome to Central Illinois' phone lines, and welcome to Howard Zinn.
Hello, Howard.
Hello.
Nice to talk to you.
Well,
hello.
Yeah, nice to talk to you, wherever you are.
This is Portland, Maine. I just picked up your book this week, and it's been I'm right in the middle of it. It's been a great read so far.
And, well, which book are you talking about?
Oh, yeah, your new book.
Oh, the new book, A Power Governments Cannot Suppress.
That'll make your publisher happy, Howard.
Yes, it's been a great read so far. And I have a page here underlined that I wanted to read real fast.
Hmm.
It's called The Ultimate Betrayal.
Well, is this a whole page you want to read?
No. I have an underline here.
You're scaring us.
Yeah.
It says, we are not historically literate enough to remember that these promises, lies, started far back in the country's past. And you're talking about the ultimate betrayal of the government. I was wondering, do you feel that the education system in the United States has been a betrayal in educating people sufficiently about history? And if so, how can we improve that our young people understand American history far better?
Mm.
Thank you, Howard.
Yeah. No, that's a very important point. I don't say it's a very important point because I made it in the book. But as you, let's put it this way, as you stated it, it is certainly an important point. And that is that our young people get a history which is a very traditional history. And in general, because there are important and admirable exceptions to this, because we have some very good teachers around the country who don't go along with this, but the traditional history that most people get is a history that doesn't prepare the young people to become critical citizens. That is, to look at what the government does with a critical eye. Take war and take the president going before the microphones and as he did in 2003 and saying we must go to war against Saddam Hussein for this reason or that reason or the other reason, and the country immediately sprang to his support, 80% support for Bush in the war. And obviously, the people who supported this did not have the kind of historical background that would enable them to say, now, hold on, wait a while. We've done this before. We've had many, many instances in which presidents have come before the public and said, we must go to war for this reason or that reason.
I mean, it was done in the Mexican War. It was done in the Spanish-American War, in the Philippines War, in Vietnam, and so on and so forth. We had many experiences like this, and it turned out that the president was deceiving the public. And the president was sending young people to die in war and to kill other people for reasons which were not disclosed to the public. The main chief reasons being for them, for the president, for the people around him, and for the corporate interests around him, main reasons being economic ones, meaning markets and raw materials and planting footholds on other continents. So if people knew this history, if they learned this kind of history in the classroom, they would not immediately rush to support the next war. So history is therefore not simply a matter of, you know, how much you know and how many tests you can pass. History is a matter of life and death. And therefore what we need is more and more history taught boldly and without fear of reprisal by teachers who insist on going outside the traditional textbooks and outside the traditional stories. The traditional stories paint a picture of a basically benign country. We always, really, if you talk to almost anybody who's gone through a traditional history education, the picture of the United States that comes across is we're basically a benign country. We're actually the best. We're the greatest. We have our little problems like slavery, or like, well, occasionally we make a mistake like Vietnam. But basically we're okay. Well, that's not quite true. An honest history would explain how this country became so powerful, how it wiped out Indian tribes ruthlessly, how it expanded into the Caribbean and took over Cuba and took over the Philippines and became an imperial power. It would be honest about the fact that we held on to slavery for 200 years and then for another 100 years held on to racial segregation, and it wasn't until black people rebelled in huge numbers that changed. So history is enormously important. I'm encouraged by the fact that there are many, many teachers now who are teaching history in a different way. I would refer you to a group in Wisconsin called Rethinking Schools. If you are a teacher or if you are a parent, contact Rethinking Schools in Milwaukee, Wisconsin, and they do a wonderful job at distributing resources, literature, ideas for teachers and for parents so as to bring a different kind of history into the educational world.
Our guest today on Media Matters, who you've just been listening to, is the historian Howard Zinn, talking to us live from his home in Massachusetts. If you'd like to talk with Howard Zinn today, the phone number here at Media Matters, 333-9455, our toll-free number, 1-800-222-9455. Howard Zinn is the author of numerous books, including the newly released A Power Governments Cannot Suppress. Let's go back to the phone lines now. Line 2, Coles County, you're on the air with Howard Zinn.
Yes, I just wanted to mention that I recommend your book, A People's History of the United States, to everyone I know. It's a tremendous classic book. And, of course, I plan to read your latest book also. In addition, I wanted to mention quickly that I am a friend of a good friend of yours, Roger Leisner of Radio Free Maine.
Oh, yes.
Who distributes your audio and video tapes of your lectures and speeches, or many of them. And I don't know if you know this, but Roger is from Central Illinois originally.
No, I didn't know that.
Yes.
I think of him as Maine. I think he's
he's
Radio Free Maine.
Well, yes, he's in Augusta, Maine now, I believe.
But he came from Illinois.
He was born in Decatur and lived near Decatur, and then he graduated from Southern Illinois University in Carbondale. So I just thought I would mention that. Roger has done a good job in distributing many of your lectures on audio and video tape. So I just thought I would mention that, that's all.
Thank you.
Okay.
Thank you very much for calling.
Okay.
There are a number of good people like that who are countering the misinformation and lack of information we get in the regular media, you know, and Roger Leisner, Radio Free Maine, is one of them. Of course, Amy Goodman and Democracy Now! And David Barsamian and Boulder with Alternative Radio. And of course, well, Bob McChesney has made an enormous contribution to creating a more democratic media. And, well, I appreciate that call.
Well, Howard, on that, along those lines, there is apparently now going to be a six-part documentary series based on your book, A People's History of the United States, being made for television. And that's going to come out next year. Is that right?
Well, actually, maybe.
It got green-lighted or yellow-lighted? What's the Hollywood term for that?
I don't know what... I think it's orange-lighted.
Orange-lighted, okay.
I think we're a ways... There are plans for a documentary based on people's history. There have been so many plans for a documentary made on people's history. And so far, we haven't actually been able to come up with it. But we're working on it now, and who knows? It may emerge.
Well, let's hope it does, because that would be a terrific addition to what we can see on television, that's for sure. You know, I wanted to ask you, one of the things you've done that I think a lot of our listeners will know about, but some might not be familiar with, is you're also a playwright. And I happen to see a play that you wrote called Marx in Soho, 3 years ago perhaps, in Madison, the performance was being held. And it was terrific. I thought it was very interesting. You wrote a play. I assume you wrote the play in the 90s at some point?
Yes.
And, you know, it was not a point at which Karl Marx was really a very widely discussed figure, even among progressives, liberals, the left in the United States. He'd sort of fallen into, if not disrepute, certainly sort of
the
margins.
I think he's like the bad child,
mm-hmm.
you're a little embarrassed by. I think there are too many people on the left. They're embarrassed by being associated with Karl Marx because they know that in the public mind, Marxism is associated with Stalinism and the Soviet Union, and which is, of course, exactly why I wrote this play to try to clarify what Marx stood for, and to distinguish between Marxism and Marxian ideas and the state dictatorship that, you know, that appeared in the Soviet Union. It's true that, as you say, that somehow Marx does not come first to mind, even among progressive people. But I was trying to show that his ideas are very, very relevant in the contemporary world.
Which ideas in particular from Marx do you think have salience today and that people should be aware of?
Well, I would say probably the most important principle in Marx, and one which is especially important for us in the United States to understand, is the importance of class. How class difference, class conflict, class struggle, how that underlies all of the political issues that we deal with. And that, you know, the first question you should ask when any political issue comes up is, who benefits from this and who doesn't? What class benefits from this policy and what class doesn't? If you ask that question about war, then, you know, the answer would be evident. If you ask that question about the latest tax proposal, that would become evident. But in this country, we grow up believing that we don't have classes in this country. There's a kind of myth that has been created. In fact, you might say it goes back to the founding fathers and the mythology surrounding them and the Constitution. The Constitution starts off with the words, in the preamble, "We the people of the United States." you know, establish this constitution. But, of course, it wasn't we the people. But when you have language like that, you begin to develop a mythology that we're all one happy family, that we really all have the same interest. In fact, we have a vocabulary that emphasizes this. We talk about the national interest as if there's one national interest, or we talk about national security as if, you know, security is the same for everybody. And so in this country especially, and I think it's not so much true in Europe or in the Third World, in this country there's a great concealment of the fact that this is a country of very sharply different class interests. Because if people believe that we all have one interest, if they believe that the interest of the government is the same as our interest, well, or if they believe that the interest of General Motors is the same as the interest of the guys who and women who work for General Motors on the assembly line, well, that deceives people into obedience to the authorities. And once you understand, if you live in the United States, once you understand that the interests of the government are not the same as yours, unless you're, you know, part of the elite, richest 1%, that the interests of the corporations are not your interests, you know, that the interests of CBS and NBC or the New York Times or the Washington Post, they are not the interests of the majority of American people. Once you understand that they have their own interests and we have ours, well, that gets rid of a lot of naivete, and that puts you on guard against the policies that come forth from them, and it then makes you look around for people like yourself who share your interests, people who are ordinary working people or professionals or business people or middle-class people, but not members of the elite, and realize that we all have a common interest, and that our common interest pits us against the class interest of the authorities who run the country.
Now, Howard, you were prominent, or at least active is perhaps a better way to put it, in the civil rights movement in the 1960s in the South when you were teaching at Spelman in Atlanta. And, you know, one of the great debates among progressives and on the left and across society to a lesser extent, but primarily on the left and among progressives, has been the idea that by talking about class, you sort of downplay then the importance of racism, of sexism, of the interest of minorities by using a broad term that doesn't really capture the specific nature of racial and gender oppression. I'm sure you've wrestled with this question.
Yeah.
How do you respond to that?
Well, it's a very important issue, and it is possible if you emphasize class to the exclusion of other factors in society that you're not doing justice to the complexity of the situation. And class isn't enough to explain the situation of black people in this country or the situation of women. But I think it's possible to give all of them the kind of emphasis and importance that they need, to exclude the issue of class, for instance, from the issue of racism in this country. This is to make a very serious mistake. One of the reasons that the civil rights movement found itself sort of floundering in the mid-1960s after sort of the victories over racial segregation and the victories in Congress with the passage of the Civil Rights Act and the Voting Rights Act, one of the reasons that the civil rights movement found itself in a kind of disarray was that it had not paid enough attention to the class interests of poor black people, so that, sure, you could have now legislation which enabled black people to go into restaurants and hotels or even to vote. But if it didn't do anything about their economic situation, then, you know, those other rights were to a large extent nullified. And Martin Luther King to his credit, understood this very well. Stokely Carmichael understood this. Malcolm X understood this. The reason that King turned his attention in 1967-68 to the economic situation of black people was that he understood that not only did the issue of racial discrimination have to be addressed, but if the poverty of black people, if economic injustice was not addressed, then you were leaving behind 80% of the black population. You might be giving jobs and attention and college education to 20% of the black population, but most black people were still living in poverty, and that's why he planned for the Poor People's Campaign in 68, and that's why he went to join the striking garbage workers in Memphis. That's when he was assassinated. I think the same thing goes for, the issue, question of gender and sex. I think they're all important, but I would insist that while you mustn't, forget, I mustn't put into the background issues of class and the rights of women, that class is fundamental. That, to put it another way, the control of wealth, the control of resources, the domination of the country by corporate wealth, that is crucial to everything else that happens.
Our guest today, Howard Zinn, Media Matters. We're doing a live show. We've got about 12, 13 minutes left. We've got a couple callers who've been patiently waiting, so let's get back to the phone lines right now. Line 4, San Francisco, you're on the air with Howard Zinn.
Hello, good morning. Can you hear me all right?
We can indeed.
I was calling because this last week or so I've been following the news, and I'm sure we all have, CNN showing the ceremonies of Donald Rumsfeld retiring. Cynthia McKinney has been in the news trying to get people interested in impeachment. Nancy Pelosi talks about implementing 9/11 commission recommendations, et cetera, et cetera. My question for Dr. Zinn is, how do you think historians will remember us in America today? And how would you like them to remember us?
Well, of course, it will depend on which historians do the remembering. My hope is that the best of the historians will understand that this was a time in which the United States was taken over by a small group of rather ruthless people. Bush and Cheney and Rumsfeld and Condoleezza Rice and who then took us into war, and then who were responsible for the deaths of huge numbers of people, and who squandered the wealth of this country and gave it to the super rich. But something else also should be remembered, and that is that a movement grew up in this country against that, a movement which very often was not recognized in the press or the media, didn't get a lot of attention, but that huge numbers of people in this country more and more opposed these policies, so that by the end of 2006, a majority of the country was opposed to the war. A majority of the country was opposed to the Bush administration. And there were growing signs of disaffection in the military, and more soldiers were coming back from Iraq, speaking out against the war. So I think historians looking back at this period, and I'm stopping it at the end of 2006 because who knows what will happen in 2007, but looking back this period, we'll see that was a desperately destructive period in American history, but one which, like all really violent and destructive periods, gives rise to movement of resistance, a movement which grows and which has the potential of changing policy.
Howard Zinn, the last 50 or 60 years has been characterized as the American century, given U.S. dominance of the world since 1945. Do you think the next 50 or 60 years will also be the American century?
No. I think that's an important, that's a really important question, because
that's why they pay me the big bucks.
And I don't think so. I mean, it has been, yes, the last part, the last 50 years of the 20th century have been a period of American domination, but I think that is coming to an end. This is an example of what I was talking about, what I was saying about, you know, that you have to take a look at, don't be deceived by what looks like overwhelming power. Here's the United States, the most powerful military apparatus. And here's a government which has taken total control of the country and of its wealth and so on. But I think that this power is fragile and is disintegrating. I think the American empire has reached its limits, and like other empires in history. It has gone too far. It has caused too much damage all over the world. It has created too many enemies all over the world. It has depleted too much of the nation's wealth and aroused not just people all over the world, but now aroused its own citizenry to oppose its policies. I believe that, yes, the next 50 years are going to see, and I'm happy to see this, the downfall of the American empire. Do you know what I remember? I remember a great line at the end of one of Michael Moore's films. I think it was maybe the very last line in the film, because the film was made right after the Soviet Union began to fall apart, right? And mm-hmm. So it was made in the early 90s. And the Michael Moore's line is, "One evil empire down, one to go."
Our guest today, Howard Zinn. Let's go back to the phone lines. And this, you know, thanks to the joys of podcasting and the internet, we get callers now from all over the country and even the world. This call's from London. Line 4, you're on the air with Howard Zinn.
Hi, thanks very much. Such a great honor to talk to you, Howard Zinn. And I just come out in the news about this Karen Ross, who was Britain's key negotiator at the UN. And he's recently submitted evidence to the Butler Commission, which is investigating the pre-war intelligence on WMDs. And basically what he's saying is that there was consensus at the UN that there was absolutely no threat from Iraq regarding WMDs, and that the 1441 was meant specifically not to give authorization for war. And a couple other things. I wondered if these had come out in America, and I'm also curious if you think that the countries are going to actually write different histories on all this.
Yeah, well, I don't know how much of that has been reported here. Maybe Bob follows the American media much better than I do, so he might be in a better position to answer this. But certainly it's very healthy that this information is coming out. Let me say one thing about weapons of mass destruction, and that is, whatever reports there were at the time about weapons of mass destruction in Iraq, let us say that they did find weapons of mass destruction in Iraq. What would that mean? Does that mean we should go to war against Iraq? Was Iraq the only country in the world that had weapons of mass destruction? There was something ironic about the fact that here was the United States sitting on 6,000 nuclear weapons with its military forces all over the world, the greatest military power. The United States possessing more weapons of mass destruction than anybody in the world, and talking about Iraq having weapons of mass destruction. It's like what's going on now with Iran. Wow, what if Iran gets a nuclear weapon? The United States has 6,000 nuclear weapons. So there's so much hypocrisy that goes on about this, and I'm glad the information that you spoke of is beginning to come out. And, you know, the more we hear about that, the more we recognize how we have been deceived, and the more it puts us on guard against anything that comes from on high.
You know, Howard Zinn, you have mentioned a couple times on the show today, and I see you write a preface on this subject for a new book edited by Peter Phillips, the idea of impeaching President Bush and Vice President Cheney. Do you think that's something that people should be working on?
Absolutely. Absolutely. I think the idea of impeachment is something that should take hold all around the country. And if the Democrats are too timid to bring this up, then we should have grassroots groups all over the country. We should have impeachment conferences in every town, impeachment hearings. In other words, instead of waiting for Congress, waiting for the House of Representatives to bring impeachment proceedings, I believe there should be impeachment hearings all over the country. After all, the situation cries out for impeachment. High crimes and misdemeanors are the requirements for impeachment. This administration is guilty of high crimes. And so I think, yes, the time is right for it. I salute Cynthia McKinney for being bold enough as her last act in leaving Congress to bring up the issue of impeachment when other leading Democrats are sort of moving the issue into the shadows. I think this is exactly the time we should be talking about impeachment.
Howard Zinn, we have time for one more caller. And have you ever heard of Frina, Illinois?
Of where?
Frina, Illinois. It's a hot spot. It's a hotbed of Media Matters listeners. We're going to go.
Frina?
Frina, that's right.
Is it spelled like the cereal?
I don't know. I haven't had the cereal, but let's say yes. Yeah. So let's go to the. We'll ask them. Line four, Frina, you're on the air with Howard Zinn.
Impeach Bush, yes. Also, I thank you for the honor of talking to a scholar. I wanted to mention that in the 1960s there was a revolution and a renaissance, and could you comment on the cultural renaissance of the 1960s of the Haight-Ashbury and rock and roll? Thank you.
All right, there you go, Howard Zinn. That's sort of a rock and roll type fan you have there.
Yes, I'm an expert on rock and roll, of course. And I love rock and roll. I love the music of the 60s. I think the cultural events of the 60s played a very, very important part in helping to build the movement. I'm thinking of the sort of comic antics of Abbie Hoffman and the Yippies. I'm thinking of the singing of Bob Dylan. Oh, you know, we need his song Masters of War sung on every radio station in every part of the country today. You know, I think of all the music of the 60s and the breaking down of barriers, the breaking down of sexual barriers of gay and lesbian people coming forth for the first time, of people living together in communes and breaking down the idea of life being dedicated to simply making money.
Howard, on that note, afraid of the band tuning up the background, which means they're going to clear me out of the studio. I want to thank you so much for joining us today, Howard Zinn, author of the brand new book, A Power Governments Cannot Suppress. I'm Bob McChesney here at Media Matters. I want to thank Colleen Cook for sitting in for Andrea Boyle today, and Brett Polson, as always, for running the board. I'll be back 1 week from today. Thank you very much.